Our West Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Both Russian President Vladimir Putin and his American counterpart Donald Trump Wednesday described bilateral relations between the countries as poor.
We may be at an all-time low in terms of relationship with Russia. This is built for a long period of time. But we're going to see what happens. Putin is the leader of Russia. Russia is a strong country. We're a very, very strong country. We're going to see how that all works out.
Mr. Putin said the level of trust on the working level, especially on the military level, has not improved and probably has degraded since Mr. Trump entered office. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson in Moscow for talks with his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, said the two governments agreed to set up a working group.
We've agreed to establish a working group to address smaller issues and make progress towards stabilizing the relationship so that we can then address the more serious problems.
Russian analyst Mark Italy of the University of Western Australia said last week's U.S. missile strike targeting a Syrian airbase following a chemical weapons attack on a northern village has not helped bilateral ties.
The bombing, a completely unilateral act by the United States and from the perspective of Russia, a clearly illegal act, has really not helped in the process, Anik.
That attack that the U.S. officials said they are convinced was carried out by Damascus left 90 civilians dead. Syria and Russia both deny Syrian involvement. Tens of thousands marched Wednesday in the South African capital Pretoria, calling on President Jacob Zuma to step down. Members of the opposition Democratic Alliance were joined by other political parties accusing Mr. Zuma of corruption and mismanagement. This is VOA News. Russia Wednesday vetoed a U.S. and British effort in the U.N. Security Council to approve a draft resolution that would condemn last week's chemical weapons attack in Syria and demand that President Bashar al-Assad cooperate with an international investigation. It was the eighth Russian veto regarding the Syrian conflict.
Еще раз повторю, вы боитесь.
The Russian Deputy Ambassador Vladimir Safronkov said the problem with the draft resolution was it assumed Syrian guilt prior to an independent investigation. He accused those supporting the document of being afraid of an impartial investigation that may show rebels at fault. Ambassador Nikki Haley said the vote could have been a turning point.
Once more, this vote could have been the moment when Russia saw that its interests do not lie with the murderous dictator, but rather with the many countries in the international community, including those across the Middle East, that want to end this conflict. By its failure, Russia will continue to be isolated.
The U.S. said Tuesday there's no doubt Syria carried out the April 4th attack. Damascus denies it. The Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons is investigating. Meanwhile, the U.N. envoy to Syria, Staffan de Mistura, warned Wednesday that what he called the fragile progress at Geneva peace talks is in grave danger.
Already in Geneva, the talks were overshadowed by an intensification of fighting on the ground and continued lack of safe, sustained, unimpeded humanitarian access.
Meanwhile, Syria and rebels have exchanged prisoners and several bodies as part of an agreement to evacuate four besieged areas around Damascus and in northern Syria that involve thousands of civilians. Egyptian security forces are beefing up their presence around Coptic Christian religious sites ahead of Easter services on Sunday, following last Sunday's suicide bombings at two churches that killed more than 40 people and were claimed by Islamic State. Church officials said they're cutting back Easter celebrations while Egyptian authorities named one of the suicide bombers involved who attacked a cathedral in Alexandria. He's identified as 31-year-old Mahmoud Hassan Mubarak Abdallah, who authorities described as a fugitive with links to militant cells. As North Korea prepares to observe the 105th birthday of founder Kim Il-sung, a U.S. think tank reports that Pyongyang is preparing a sixth nuclear test. The 38 North website said the North's Pungyung-ri test site is, quote, primed and ready. Meanwhile, Reuters reports foreign journalists visiting the capital, Pyongyang, are awaiting a big and important event. Tensions have heightened since President Donald Trump dispatched a carrier strike group to the region, promising to act alone, if necessary, to end the North Korean nuclear and missile threat. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Thursday, April 13th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Sierra Leone's former vice president says he's returning home today, Thursday, more than a year after he was sacked by the ruling APC.
I'm going to Sierra Leone in order to register to vote and other issues or privileges that are related to registering for the 2018 presidential, general, and local council elections.
Chief Samuel Sam-Sumana is Sierra Leone's former vice president. The United Nations says there's been a sharp increase in the use of child suicide bombers by Boko Haram. South Sudan's vice president proposes a national conference to discuss the violence in the country. And Zambia's opposition UPND party demands the immediate release of its leader, Hakainde Hichilema.
The facts do not support the provision of the law to say that he intentionally endangered the life of the president when he was not the driver. Lungu's convoy was overtaking the convoy of Hakainde, and there was no one who blocked the presidential motorcade.
Jack Mwimbu is the defense attorney for jailed Zambia opposition leader Hakainde Hichilema. And guinea worm may soon be eradicated as a new research reveals the huge burden of the disease. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Sierra Leone's former vice president, Samuel Sam-Sumana, says he's returning home today, Thursday, to register to vote in next year's presidential and legislative elections. Mr. Sam-Sumana was expelled from the ruling APC party in 2015 for allegedly lying about his academic qualifications and anti-party activities. Soon after, he was dismissed by President Ernest Bai Koroma. He sued the Sierra Leone government in the ECOWAS Community Court of Justice about what he called his unconstitutional removal as vice president. In the meantime, Mr. Sam-Sumana's lawyer has written to President Koroma to guarantee the former vice president's security. From Accra, Ghana, Mr. Sam-Sumana tells me he's also concerned the government might try to seize his diplomatic passport upon arrival in Sierra Leone.
I'm going to Sierra Leone in order to register my civic rights so that I can not be disenfranchised.
In other words, you're going to register to vote?
Yes, to vote and other issues or privileges that are related to registering for the 2018 presidential, general, and local council elections.
Do you have a political party under which you are going to register? After all, we know that you have been dismissed from the ruling APC party.
I don't think it's a criterion to belong to a political party in order to register. But at the moment, to your question, I don't belong to any political party, but I am going to register as a Sierra Leonean and to also exercise my political ambition.
So do you have any intention of running in the 2018 election as a presidential candidate?
A big yes to you and to the entire nation of Sierra Leone and the world at large.
Mr. Vice President, your lawyer has written to President Ernest Bai Koroma asking him to guarantee your safety and security. Do you fear your safety is in danger when you return to Sierra Leone?
Well, yes. The reason being we raised the issue is that when I was leaving Sierra Leone to come out purposely just for a break, I was harassed at the airport when I had already embarked on the aircraft. We stopped the aircraft, but for some reason, the aircraft had to depart Sierra Leone airspace. And after that, I've been in Sierra Leone, there have been a lot of threats, attempts of going to upcountry, saying that we had buried ammunition in my compound in Kono, my home district. All are frivolous allegations about violence, and I'm trying to stage issues that can incriminate me.
What kind of passport do you have? Do you have an ordinary Sierra Leonean passport or do you have a diplomatic passport? And are you not concerned that if you have a diplomatic passport, that the government can confiscate that upon your arrival?
Yes, I've been hearing word that upon my arrival, they want to confiscate my passport. But it is very unfortunate that even other previous vice presidents of Sierra Leone are carrying diplomatic passports. And there's a process of retrieving passport, not at the airport. So I have been informed that this is what is going on.
What has become of your case that you filed in the ECOWAS Community Court of Justice about what you call your unconstitutional removal from the office of the vice president?
My case in the ECOWAS court is based on human rights, and my lawyers have been handling this issue. I have said it from another media that I do not want to prejudice my case until I go to court, and after that, then we can talk about it.
What do you say to some Sierra Leoneans who say that Sam Sumana is coming home to cause trouble for the Sierra Leone government?
To my fellow Sierra Leoneans, I will say to you that I have demonstrated along the years while serving in public office that you gave me the opportunity for two terms as the vice president of Sierra Leone. There is no record of violence. There is no record of insubordination on my part. And I'm very proud to state that as a peaceful citizen, to the oath of office that I took to uphold and maintain the Constitution of Sierra Leone, there is no aspect in the Constitution that I violated. And also, there is no aspect of the Constitution that states that violence can be used. So inasmuch I did my part to maintain and uphold the Constitution of Sierra Leone, I will forever remain to do so.
Mr. Vice President, it's so nice to talk with you on Daybreak Africa, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. And I'll be in Sierra Leone today, Thursday, and I hope you follow us through the report to the rest of the world.
Chief Samuel Sam Sumana is Sierra Leone's former vice president. He was speaking with me from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. The United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, says that there's been an alarming surge in the number of children being used as suicide bombers by the Boko Haram militant group in the conflict engulfing the Lake Chad region of West Africa. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Data gathered by the UN Children's Fund shows children were used as suicide bombers in 27 attacks in the first quarter of 2017. That is three times more than during the same period last year and nearly the same number as the whole of 2016. The militant Islamist group Boko Haram has been forcing children to blow themselves up in Nigeria, Chad, Niger, and Cameroon since 2014. As the Islamist group finds itself on the run, it reportedly is resorting increasingly to this tactic to spread terror among civilian populations of the Lake Chad region. UNICEF spokesman Christophe Bouyrak says Boko Haram uses children rather than adults as human bombs because they can be easily manipulated and more likely to escape scrutiny. He tells VOA girls are mostly used in these attacks.
Since January 2014, among the 117 children that have been used in suicide attacks, more than 80% of them are girls. So girls are particularly exposed to this horrific practice.
Bouyrak says children are viewed with deep suspicion by the authorities and public at large. He says children who have escaped captivity from Boko Haram often hide what they have experienced when they return to their communities.
They fear the stigmatization and even sometimes the violent reprisal from their community, who might at some point think that these children are still dangerous. And it's important in any case to remember that these children are victims. They are not perpetrators.
UNICEF says local authorities often hold children intercepted at checkpoints in prolonged periods of administrative custody. It is calling for an end to this practice and for the children who often are severely traumatized by their experiences to be immediately handed over to civilian authorities who can support them. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Barton, Washington. Today's Thursday, April 13th. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour. The defense attorney for Zambia's main opposition leader, Hakainde Hichilema, has demanded the immediate and unconditional release of his client. Jack Mwimbu says the charges against Mr. Hichilema, leader of the United Party for National Development, UPND, are politically motivated. Zambian police charged Mr. Hichilema with 4 counts of treason after he was accused of putting the life of President Edgar Lungu in danger by refusing to give way to the presidential convoy. Mr. Hichilema has refused to recognize President Lungu as the legitimately elected Zambian president following last year's elections. Defense attorney Mwibu tells VOA's Peter Clarty the police do not have evidence to support the charges against Mr. Hichilema.
You may not be aware that he has been charged with treason contrary to Section 1A of the Penal Code Caps 87 of the laws of Zambia. That is Section 43-1A, which states, a person is guilty of treason and shall be liable to suffer death. A, who prepares or endeavors to overthrow by unlawful means the government as by law established. Surely, any person can see that the facts and the charge do not in any way tally.
The call for his unconditional release, some in Zambia are saying, will not be heard because the government, and for that matter, the police, seem convinced that Hakainde Hichilema, who has refused to recognize President Edgar Changwa Lungu as the legitimate leader of the country, purposely endangered the president's life by refusing to give way, which is treasonous, they argue.
The facts do not support the provision of the law. And the way to say that he intentionally endangered the life of the president when he was not the driver. And two, Mr. Hakainde Hichilema and several others were in a convoy of more than 100 vehicles. And he was in one of the vehicles that were heading in the same direction with the convoy of Lungu. Lungu's convoy was overtaking the convoy of Hakainde, and there was no one who blocked the presidential motorcade. Nobody.
Officials of the ruling Patriotic Front Party are denying that these charges are politically motivated and that Hakainde Hichilema will face the justice system. If he is found not guilty, he will be released, and that the judicial process will be free, fair, and transparent. Your take?
You may not be aware that before the charges were leveled against Hakainde Hichilema, the Deputy Secretary General of the ruling party and the spokesperson of the ruling party had a press conference where they called for the resignation of the Inspector General of Police because he did not provide the requisite security measures for the president on his way to this particular function. And the special assistant to the president also issued a statement to the effect that the police failed their duty. They did perform their functions professionally because they failed to clear the road for the president to move freely. Those are the statements coming from the Patriotic Front and the spokesperson for Lungu. And in that same press conference, they instructed the Inspector General of Police to charge Hakainde Hichilema with treason. It came from the party and the government before the police could do anything. The police, they woke up from slumber and decided to agree with the party that there must be treason. Hence this foolish charge they have come up with, which is not supported by any fact. That is the situation on the ground. And they have been clamoring that recognition should be given to Lungu. But the UPND has been saying, look, let the matter be concluded in court. If the court finds in favor of Lungu or Hakainde, then a decision will be made. If it's in favor of Lungu, UPND will recognize him. So there is nothing wrong with that. But our friends in the ruling party and government have been incensed by this particular provision in the stance of the UPND that they can only do that after the whole court matter is concluded, which is a civilized manner of resolving disputes.
Are the police to blame for these charges against Hakainde Hichilema that you say, you know, there's no evidence to support it?
They are acting unprofessionally. If they were professionals in the police force, they would not have raised the charges against Hakainde. I can tell you the other, because he has been charged with 4 counts. Count one is one on treason. The second count is failing to obey instructions from a traffic officer. How can you charge, you know, a passenger with such an offense? He's not the one who's driving.
Jack Muimbu is the defense attorney for Zambia's main opposition leader, Hakainde Hichilema. He spoke with VOA's Peter Clotty from the capital, Lusaka. South Sudan's vice president is urging officials in President Salva Kiir's government not to allow the country to collapse in their hands as deadly violence continues across the country. James Wani Iga spoke to lawmakers on Wednesday about what form the national dialogue should take. He then proposed holding a national conference to gather the views of all South Sudanese, including the armed opposition. As Tito Justin reports from Juba, government officials admit the criminal actions of some security agents could derail any possibility of holding a national dialogue.
Vice President Iga told dozens of South Sudanese government officials South Sudan tried to sign an agreement to resolve conflict in the country, but the peace deal is, in his words, standing on one leg. He says he is concerned that the situation is becoming more and more complex and the continued violence is tearing the country apart.
We cannot allow our country to be destroyed in this way, to be fragmented. We really have to do something, especially we, the leaders of today. So please, it is a difficult time, and let us hold the bull by the horns.
Last month, Information Minister Michael Makwe announced preconditions for armed groups participating in the national dialogue, saying they and people living in rebel-controlled areas must first renounce rebellion.
For the opposition, as long as they continue to be called armed opposition and they have not denounced violence, then they don't deserve to even talk about this dialogue, because originally they don't accept whatever is done by the government.
Striking a more conciliatory tone, Iga says the process must be inclusive if it is going to achieve the intended objectives. In addition, he says, transparency and public participation by people from all walks of life will enable leaders to understand people's grievances. Iga is also suggesting that the Kiir administration give general amnesty to all groups and individuals that took up arms against the government and release individuals being detained in connection with the ongoing conflict.
An effective national dialogue convened on broad basis of stakeholders for a meaningful deliberative process. In this sense, all main interest groups, ranging from women, youth, major groups, transitional groups, political parties, including those in the opposition and so on, should be invited to partake. If we omit them, then we are likely to fail in this, and we are unlikely to resolve the conflict.
Iga urged the lawmakers in the General Assembly and the Kiir administration to take the national dialogue very seriously and to visit their constituencies and spread the message of peace.
National dialogue is an instrument which can lead to conflict resolution, political transformation, peaceful coexistence, and we need peaceful coexistence regardless of the 64 tribes, and opening up the political space for participation of the civil society. We need our civil society to participate effectively.
President Salva Kiir announced the dialogue would begin in early March, but due to financial constraints, officials say the event has yet to be scheduled. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
A regional conference about family planning in the Sahel has been taking place this week in the Senegalese capital, Dakar. Participants have been discussing ideas that can help improve women's health and access to quality reproductive services. Mabinge Ngom, the Western Central Africa director of the United Nations Population Fund, spoke to Ricky Stryak on the sidelines of the conference about obstacles facing contraceptive providers in the region.
No, I think what we want is really to scale up ongoing intervention, because we have a high demand for instance, family planning, access to family planning services, you know, and we do not have, you know, the capacity to respond to the huge demand, you know, even when a woman want to have access to family planning services, I think we are not yet able to provide them with these life-saving services they need, including in the six countries of the Sahel.
What are some of the obstacles in places like Niger, where you have lots of desert, not as much infrastructure, and sometimes you have to deal with places in northern Mali where there's conflict?
Well, I think Niger have the highest total fertility rate, you know, across the world. And this very specific situation is mainly due to, you know, child marriage. Child marriage is really driving the high population growth we experience today in Niger.
Is that because people start having babies at such a young age and
exactly,
they continue?
Exactly. You know, it's child marriage. You know, early marriage lead to women, you know, leaving the education system, you know, at a very early age, but also the tendency for women to end up by having, you know, a large number of children. So if you address, for example, child marriage by, you know, enacting some laws, you know, like what happened in Chad a few months ago, just, you know, to discourage this very harmful practice, I think you also can, you know, do something about education by keeping girls at school. You know, every 2 years you keep the girls in the secondary school, you reduce by 1 year the age of the first delivery. So I think child marriage is one. Girl education is something that is really important to be supportive. And number three, we should not underscore the need to ensure that women have access to family planning services. Access to family planning will not only address the issue of high population growth, but is the best instrument to address the high maternal mortality we experience today in Africa. 679 women die for every 100,000 births in Africa. It is the highest rate we have today around the world. And we will not succeed on our efforts, you know, to win the agenda we set for the Sustainable Development Goal if we do not address the issue of family planning, the issue of high population growth, and the issue of child marriage.
That was Mambinge Ngom, the Western Central Africa Director of the United Nations Population Fund, who was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Dakar, Senegal. Guinea worm is on course to become the second human disease to be eradicated after smallpox, thanks largely to intervention overseen by former U.S. President Jimmy Carter. Little was known about the infection for decades as diseases like malaria took priority. But previously unpublished research from the 1970s, released this month, shows the burden the disease has had on millions of people. Henry Richwell reports from London.
Guinea worm is contracted when people drink water contaminated with tiny crustaceans that contain the worm larvae. A year later, a metre-long female worm emerges through a painful blister, often disabling the infected person for months. Professor Brian Greenwood, a British scientist, first came across guinea worm in the 1970s when working in northern Nigeria. He says little was known about the disease, despite millions suffering from it across Africa and India.
People are much more concerned with malaria and other bilharzia and other tropical infections. And part of the reason was that these people were so disabled, they never got to the clinic or the hospital. So that if you looked in hospital records, you didn't see this as a big problem.
Greenwood spent 4 years studying the disease and trying to find out why sufferers often developed repeat infections without developing immunity.
We extracted some of the worms, and the traditional way is winding them out on a matchstick, just gradually. And the problem is if the worm then snapped inside, then they got a very severe reaction.
Greenwood credits the Carter Center, a charitable foundation set up by former US President Jimmy Carter, for helping to fight the disease to the brink of eradication. There is no vaccine or treatment. Instead, community education programs teach people to filter drinking water and avoid entering water sources.
That's reporter Henry Richwell reporting from London. And that's it for this Thursday, April 13th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer John Ellison. I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good day.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Anybody, anybody, anybody. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.